Hey, my name is Ron Roger. I'm an actor from such shows as Matlock, Stranger Things, Power Rangers, and maybe a few more. You are listening to KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles. Today.
The Expansion Zone with Sonia Barrett.
Everybody's talking about consciousness. Everybody wants that eternal kiss. Yeah, everyone's saying there's more than this. Everyone wants to follow their own bliss. Talking about one love, one blood. We sing
on the Expansion Zone. We examine life and our quest to understand who and what we are and of the vastness of human potentials. We explore the making of our world from quantum physics to parapsychology, health, sociology, and philosophy, along with practical living. You are reminded of the possibilities in creating personal change. So for an hour, we'll stimulate and expand the mind. Well, welcome once again to the Expansion Zone with Sonia Barrett. I'm, of course, your host, Sonia Barrett, and thank you for joining me today on this Monday and wishing you the best Monday, whatever that may be, whatever the possibilities are. I'm hoping that they are wonderful opportunities for you today as you start your week. Thanks to Donna DeLore for the use of her song, Be the Change, which is the intro for the Expansion Zone. Very appropriate, as always. Be the Change is always a mindset that we should hold, especially right now. We really need that. So today's topic is the Roswell deception and the demystification of World War II. Well, today we have an interesting interview. And in light of that interview, I decided that I would share an excerpt from the documentary, The Roswell UFO Conclusion, Lies, Conspiracies, and Confessions. I'm actually adding this excerpt after this interview was done. And I think at this point, where we are in time with this entire disclosure discussion and just period, the period that we're in, you could decide, you know, I'm sharing the excerpt from that. And then you also hear Peter Moon's interview and you decide. They are going to be, I think, a bit different, at least this excerpt anyway that I'm sharing in terms of what Peter is talking about. Anyway, just listen to it and explore for yourself. It is not really my intention to focus on this disclosure period at all, but I just thought it would be a great idea to add this excerpt from this documentary in 2023, again, which is being added after the fact of having done this interview with Peter Moon.
And that it was a special air balloon which they couldn't talk about. And then that somehow later on near Roswell, crash dummies landed on ground. And that somehow the likes of Marcel Blanchard and everybody else involved with the Roswell story is mistaken. That somehow they have put together two stories which happened several years ago, several years apart, and that they can't tell what really happened at Roswell. But that the American government knows perfectly well, and you just have to trust them that they know perfectly well.
In 1947, if the government told you to keep a secret, it was considered your patriotic duty to hold that information. Jesse Marcel Sr. was loyal to his country, and above all else, he was a patriot. During the press conference, Marcel was told to pose with materials from a Mogul balloon. Though he knew it was not the materials he had brought back from Corona, he complied with his orders.
you know, that says a couple things about him. One, he could be trusted with information that was obviously very valuable to the war that they didn't trust, you know, the 99.9% of the people with. And he was one of those people they it tells a little bit about himself and his ability to, you know, you can imagine, I'm about to work with a team, I'm going to tell them where to drop a bomb, it's going to kill thousands and thousands of people. To take that responsibility and to be able to put yourself aside and follow your orders, and that's exactly what he did. He really paid for that later in life.
Under orders from Colonel Blanchard, Jesse Marcel and a man in plain clothes took the crash debris back to the Roswell Air Base. There it was flown to Wright-Patterson and sequestered away to be studied. The broken pieces of the craft were kept in a secure location codenamed the Blue Room, and the legend of Roswell was born.
What is the Blue Room? Various question marks exist as to whether or not there is a facility at Wright-Patterson Air Field Base, which really is the container of everything which your government doesn't want you to know. It is said that within the Blue Room, the secrets of UFOs can be found. And some even suggest that the name Blue Room has to do with the fact that in the 1950s there was a government inquiry called Project Blue Book, which allegedly went in search of the truth as to what UFOs were all about, but in reality was just another cover-up. It's probably no coincidence that one of the people who was involved with Project Blue Book was Roger Remy, the guy who in 1947, a few years later, told Jesse Marcel to deny the truth as to what happened in Roswell. He was the one who pushed the weather balloon into Jesse Marcel's hands and basically told him to go on the record and say that he had misidentified a weather balloon as a flying saucer.
When it went to Hangar 18, that was pretty much the end of my grandmother's direct contact with the material. You know, up to that point, he was able to handle it, that sort of thing. On a side story, while all of this happening, there was, if you recall, the debris field was approximately a span shape, 3/4 mile long, littered fairly evenly with material. The more perceptible would be the foil you can see from the sun shining, but in the debris field, soon after, there was a call and there was actually a crashed hull of a UFO about 25 miles away. Now, my grandfather was not involved in that whatsoever. He did not see it, he wasn't part of it, but he also stood by the people who saw it. He said, I didn't see it, but the people who talked about this, I believe them. I mean, there's no reason not to believe his co-workers and other people in intelligence. When they went out to investigate it, you know, saying, why didn't my grandfather investigate that site? The bigger this became, the military does like to compartmentalize things. They would not want to have one individual having all of the information. So it goes hand in hand as to why he would not have been part of that second site. The second site was interesting. There's reports of alien bodies, of an alien that actually had lived and through the crash injured but was alive. And that became the story came down to where on the base there's medical work done on cadavers of aliens, that sort of thing.
Major Jesse Marcel never saw the bodies, but it is clear that a few days later bodies were recovered. And so what we have here is a story of two halves. The story of somebody who has handled material which he absolutely knew was not of this earth. And a few days later he probably got confirmation, when they found the bodies, that indeed this material came not from this planet. In the 3 weeks following Roswell, Jesse Marcel was given leave, and we don't know what happened, whether he was put somewhere and questioned or whether he became part of the people who was allowed to investigate the Roswell crash any further. But it is clear that once he returned to Roswell, either immediately or in the coming weeks, that he began to speak to other people. And even though he probably didn't get definitive proof, as in another I-beam in his hands, he probably knew more than anybody else that what really had happened at Roswell was precisely
what we are piecing together. The story of an extraterrestrial craft which crash-landed in the desert just north of Roswell, New Mexico.
Every historical event can be traced back to a pivotal moment, a moment in time when everything changed. For the Marcel family, that moment was the evening when Jesse Marcel Sr. brought home a box of debris from the crash site. It is this moment when the event became real for them and would be handed down through each generation.
My father looked on one of the beams, they're like little I-beams, anywhere from 4 inches, 12 inches, 18 inches, and there was a box that might have had several pieces that were longer than that. And they said, you look on there's like an aluminum beam, I-beam cross-section, I-cross-section, and it looked just plain. It looked like it was kind of the same material as the foil parts that he also brought back, and just had structure to them rather than a very light foil. And if you looked at them dead on, there wasn't anything appreciable, but if you held it at an angle, then these symbols would appear on in between the shoulders, it's called. And especially if you held the light a certain way, they became very perceptible. They were like a light violet in color. And my grandfather at that point remarked that you guys are probably the first ones to ever see this alien language in history. So nobody's ever seen this before. And they...
to the expansion zone.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Peter, so this book is a topic. Everybody knows this topic of Roswell. Not that they have any of the information correct, but we all know from TV shows and so on. So just to maybe give like a little summary of the idea of this book project.
Okay. Roswell obviously occurs as World War II has wound down in 1947, July 8th, the Roswell Army Airfield releases a press release basically saying that the 509th Operations Group had recovered a flying disc, which had crashed at a ranch near Roswell. Of course, and then they retract it. And of course, ever since there has been this idea that the Army was hiding a flying saucer. And there are stories about little small aliens that were recovered. Some accounts have them have three fingers. The mortician was Army ordered three small coffins. And there are other myths and assortment of data and or facts that have been gathered to create a mythos of aliens, the aliens landed. The Air Force responded to this in the 1990s when there was so much jibber jabber about it. And there was so much, and the Roswell Museum was created. And they came out and said that the Air Force was testing crashed dummies, doing test crash on crashed dummies. Well, the most disingenuous part about that, and it was a huge, long report. Well, the Air Force didn't even exist in 1947, July 8th. It came into being, you know, after Roswell. So there is no way the Air Force was testing with crash dummies. This is just stupid. But anyway, all of it gives the impression and is meant to give the impression that the government is hiding that aliens crashed and that there's this collaboration between aliens and the United States government. And of course, all of these myths were fostered further in the early 1950s with mostly B movies about flying saucers and aliens that young teenagers would see in drive-ins, or old teenagers would see in drive-ins, and young people would see in drive-ins. And a drive-in movie. When you took your car and watched the movie on a screen. So this is a myth that has been perpetrated and created. There was also The Day the Earth Stood Still, a movie that was movie, and it was the show that, you know, aliens had landed on the lawn of the Capitol in Washington, D.C. So they were here to stop, you know, atomic warfare. And all this is Hollywood was what do you call it? Co-opted by the military. Many of these people had carrying cards as military or government agents. Marilyn Monroe's is online if you want to see it. They were working for the government. But in any case, but to understand Roswell, you have to understand the underpinnings of what was behind it. And this has to do with World War II. World War II, and that's why the book is called And the Demystification of World War II, because it's to be demystified. There are so many false facts. They're not facts. They appear as facts, faux facts, about World War II. And there is an opening statement at the beginning of the book, which is, and of course, I should mention that my co-author, Douglas Dietrich, was a research librarian for the Defense Department of the United States of America. And his office or his library where he worked was at the Presidio in San Francisco. And the Presidio takes up a huge portion of the city of San Francisco. When you come into San Francisco from the north, from Marin County, and you cross the Golden Gate Bridge, there is the Presidio. You're on the Presidio. And when I was a kid and you came in that way, it was like, you can't go there. You can't go touch foot on the Presidio. Now it is a park and you can go there. Anybody can go there because Douglas Dietrich single-handedly responsible for getting that Presidio base shut down. And that's true. That's absolutely true. And that's actually another story. But he was working as a Defense Department research librarian. And when he began working there, he was told he had to burn documents. They had an incinerator. And the last person who worked there had fallen into the incinerator. He came to work drunk. He fallen and he was badly hurt. And it was such a pall on everybody's emotions that nobody wanted to go there. Nobody wanted to burn documents. Nobody wanted to go there. So basically all this material to be burned stacked up. And there was information, Spanish-American War, because the Presidio is the biggest military base was west of the Mississippi. It was the Pentagon of the West Coast. It was second only to the Pentagon. Its history goes back into the Spanish days. It is the oldest military installation on the western part of the United States, save for the Presidio at Monterey, which is older, but never as substantial as the one in San Francisco. So Douglas was working there. He was ordered to burn the documents. It was above his pay grade. He protested, but he did it anyway. But he also read them and he took notes because he couldn't take them off campus. The Roswell information, or most of it, was not actually information that he was assigned to burn. He was actually assigned to collate for the base commander. He's not sure why the base commander wanted it, but he collated all this information, much of which was in crates that said crypto top secret and highest security clearance, all above his pay grade. He protested, it didn't matter. He went ahead and did it, but he took notes. He's a really voracious reader. He can read and retain, and he go home and take notes. So much of what we have here is thanks to his incredible memory. And I begin the book with an opening statement, and there are two major myths that are going to be deconstructed. Much as a lawyer would make an opening statement in a courtroom. And the myth number one, and this is to deconstruct World War II as it relates to Roswell. Myth number one is that the Empire of Japan was an aggressor nation who attacked Pearl Harbor without provocation or just cause. And further, as a direct result of atomic bombs being dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, Imperial Japan surrendered unconditionally, it being announced by Emperor Hirohito on August 15th and formally signed on September 2nd, 1945 aboard the USS Missouri, thus bringing the hostilities of World War II to a close. All of that is false, except for the fact that atomic bombs were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But Japan did not surrender unconditionally. They did not surrender at all. And there was no surrender ceremony that was real on September 2nd, 1945. Aboard the USS Missouri. There was a ceremony aboard the Missouri, but it was not a surrender, nor was there an end of hostility. And I will address that in just a moment. Myth number two is based upon a 1947 press release from the Roswell Army Airfield. Public information officer Walter Haupt, the seeds of a myth were created when a story was circulated in the Roswell Daily Record that personnel had recovered a flying disc, which had crashed on a ranch near Roswell. Now, it was flown to higher headquarters, and on that same day, a story was reported that a Roswell couple claimed to have seen a large unidentified object fly by their home on July 2nd. Well, that was true. That was true. People did see an unidentified object. Now, days later, there was a retraction. Brigadier General Roger Ramey examined the debris covered by Jesse Marcel, and it was determined to be a weather balloon. It was described as a bunch of tinfoil, broken wood beams, and rubber remnants of a balloon. Now, this is the Army going back on what they said. It's not a flying saucer. It's a weather balloon. It was not a weather balloon.
So you're saying it was actually a flying saucer?
No, it was neither.
It was neither. Okay.
No, we'll get to that. And there was an additional story of W.W. Brazel of Lincoln County, who claimed that he and his son had found the material on June 14th when they came upon a large area of bright wreckage made up of rubber strips, tin foil, a rather tough paper, and sticks. Now, he doesn't say it's a weather balloon. It's rubber strips, tin foil, tough paper, and sticks. He picked up the debris on July 4th, and then he heard about the flying discs and wondered if it might have been that. And they contacted the sheriff who notified Major Marcel, who picked it up. Now, a lot of this was revived over the years. Additional witnesses would talk about a metal, retractable metal, and it had in aspects of the craft that had unintelligible hieroglyphics. There were also accounts of yellowish, orange, or gray hairless bodies with three fingers being recovered near the crash, which were put in child-sized coffins. Now, this myth became what I could call recapitulated, polished up, and brushed off and recirculated with this book called The Day After Roswell by Philip Corso and Bill Burns. Now, I remember this book because it completely knocked the hell out of the momentum I had as a publisher of Strange Topics. You know, everybody's going after The Day After Roswell. Oh, you just felt them going like lemmings off a cliff. I was not impressed by it because the guy seemed quite nuts, Philip Corso. He was a special assistant to the head of Army Research and Development, Lieutenant General Arthur Trudeau, and was in the Foreign Technology Desk. And he claimed that modern technology has been in great part the result of reverse engineering that was discovered in the Roswell crash. And this is just not true. However, I'm going to go back into the first one, myth number one about World War One. And okay, September 2nd, 1945, unconditional surrender aboard the Missouri. Now, if you want to look up, even on Wikipedia, which is a government-controlled page that refuses to have my bio, they won't let me put a bio up there, nor of my friend, Dr. David Anderson.
Interesting.
Yeah, they won't. But anyway, I've tried, but they won't. Well, they had one on, and they took it off. It wasn't very expository, but they took it off. Yes. I am mentioned on Wikipedia. They can't avoid that because they mention my name in the Montauk Project stuff, but it doesn't, they don't allow the story to be told. So in any case, unless you're the right fit,
protocol.
Anyway, because it gets you a lot of circulation, that's why. Mm-hmm. But anyway, you can look on Wikipedia or in any history reference, Japan signed a peace treaty in September of 1951 with the Allies. And it went into effect on the emperor's birthday, April 28th, which is actually kind of his birthday eve because the 28th is his birthday in Japan, which is the 29th. But it was deliberately meant to go into effect on the emperor's birthday by insistence of the emperor, 1952. Further, you can find videos of Harry Truman announcing a cessation of hostilities in World War II on the last day of 1946. So here you have what's wrong with this picture. An unconditional surrender does not necessitate a peace treaty. Surrender. There were hostilities going on. So what happened? The Emperor of Japan was also considered to be not a war criminal. He was just portrayed as a kindly old fool who was misled by Prime Minister Tojo in all these people. And these people were executed in what were considered to be show trials by the press because they didn't go after the real war criminals. And Japan was not a part of the, what's the treaty they call, the Geneva Convention.
Oh, Geneva Convention.
They were not part of that. So, but in any case, there is so much misunderstood. Emperor Hirohito was a young prince who was sent by his father to study under a man named General Nogi, who was a true samurai in the traditional sense of the word, and also a general who had been very important to fighting the Russians in the Japanese-Russo war, which the Japanese had won. And the Japanese and Russians are still at war to this day. They're still at war to this day. World War II peace treaties be damned. Russians are still at war with Japan. But that doesn't mean they're actively fighting them so much, but technically it just kind of, you know, dies up, but the hostilities are still very much there. But so Hirohito was being trained by this general, and he read a story by Jack London, the famous writer and who wrote Cold Wild. And he was a reporter in the Russo-Japanese War. And he was horrified by what he experienced in during the war, especially when he was captured and whatnot in, I think it was Chinese. And he wrote this short story called The Unparalleled Invasion, which was published internationally in several languages, including Japanese, but Hirohito already read English. And it horrified Emperor Hirohito because this story advocated complete abolition of the yellow race, genocide of the yellow race. The yellow race at that time primarily referred to Chinese, but it also had crossed over to apply to Japanese. And it really didn't matter to Hirohito. He says, if they're going to do this to the Chinese, they'll do it to us. So he basically told his mentor, General Nogi, he says, you know, your swords, your weapons, these will do nothing. He says, we have to embrace a new kind of warfare. And he knew well that the Americans had done German warfare to win World War I. There's a whole chapter on that in the book. The H1N1 virus was created under the stewardship of Woodrow Wilson in World War I because he wanted to get in World War I. He wasn't in the action, and he wanted to have he wanted the League of Nations. He wanted to unite the world. And his generals came to him and explained the history of variolation, which was the early word for vaccination. And they could take substances instead of vaccinating people, they could infect people. And they could do this with what actually became H1N1 virus. But they did this with smallpox earlier. The United States had a history of doing it. In fact, you know, getting rid of Indians with smallpox. So the H1N1 virus was cultivated and basically fostered upon. They took prisoners, put them into the army, sent them to Leavenworth and other locations, infected them with the virus on purpose, and sent them over to fight in the war, World War I. And this effectively ended the war because it killed so many people. We're talking about hundreds of millions. What's going on with COVID today, and if you accept it at face value, the numbers at face value, and don't assume or believe that they're only 50% or 75% accurate, if you accept the figures of the U.S. government as being actual, it pales in comparison to what went on during World War I. Hundreds of millions of people, 300 million people died, let alone infected worldwide. And this ended World War I. It wasn't military superiority. It wasn't the Yanks are coming. It was the Yanks are coming is their Spanish, they called it the Spanish flu, because when the initial troops landed, they landed in Spain, they were called coffin ships because most of the sailors were dead from the virus. But those that landed came, got in the foxholes, and it spread. And this was not anything an army could fight.
Yes, it was like wildfire spreading.
Exactly. And so this... Of course, Hirohito, the Japanese were allies of America during World War I, but they knew what Americans would do. And it wasn't so much that there was active hostilities at that time from America, but he knew what their mindset was. And there was also Japan had suffered very badly at the hands of America in the 1850s when Commodore Matthew Perry sailed into the, I think it was Tokyo Harbor, but he sailed into Japan at gunpoint, forced them to become a trading partner with the rest of the world because they were an isolationist country. And Japan had suffered from the Chinese before. And there's a whole history of an earlier emperor praying when Kublai Khan had tried to invade him. He tried to invade him a couple times, and then when it failed because of typhoons or whatnot, he sent a huge bunch of ships back there, and the emperor who was defenseless, he prayed to their divinity and to the what were called the kamikaze, divine winds. Kamikaze means divine winds. And on August 15th, the same day that Hirohito is said to have surrendered, which he didn't. It's quite the reverse. The United States accepted his terms. But on August 15th, on the day of the great kamikaze winds that destroyed Kublai Khan's fleets and saved Japan, it was by, I think that was a deadline that Hirohito had set for the America to accept his, you know, his terms. So anyway.
Peter, let's go ahead, and we do need to take a break. Stay tuned, everybody. We'll be right back after this brief break.
Give a gift to KPFK and yourself when you let us take your unwanted vehicle off your hands. Not only will your donation help support the on-air programs our community relies on every day, but you even qualify for a tax deduction. Go to kpfk.org/cars or call 877-573-5288. That's 1-877-KPFK-AUTO to learn more.
And we are back. We're coming to you from KPFK 90.7 FM in Southern California and streaming live at kpfk.org. You are listening to The Expansion Zone with Sonia Barrett. That is me, your host. And today we're speaking with Peter Moon, and we're discussing his most recent book project, The Roswell Deception and the Demystification of World War II. Interesting stuff. And I don't want to, you're going to pick up from where you left off, but I just needed to throw this in, Peter. But there's a part there that I was reading, and I'm just going to read it very quickly, where it says what the Americans had won would haunt them for the rest of the century. Their enemies would certainly, most certainly did not forget the American Army and Navy flu and what Wilson had wrought on the population of Europe, to say nothing of his own citizens. As a result, Adolf Hitler, again, of course, I don't have the rest of the quote right here. Anyway, it moves on to say, salute instead of shaking hands. That was what was...
Yes. The German salute, Mussolini and Hitler instituted the, I think it was the Roman salute, because...
Yes, Roman salute.
For hygienic purposes. Because you're not going to pass germs by doing that salute.
Well, that's the interesting thing, because I didn't know that history. I didn't realize that was the purpose of that. But what was interesting, though, is my conclusion, and I'm trying to stay safe away from saying certain things, but about the symbolism of face covering, that was the symbolism that I had been using, that it was symbolic to that salute. Anyway, I just wanted to throw that in. And so when I read this, it made perfect sense to me. It all just sort of came together. Anyway, I just
a lot of things come together in this book. And anyway, so Hirohito became a professor, a doctor. He got a doctorate in marine biology. Most people don't know this. And he studied the currents. He studied, which include the winds. And he put together a very ambitious program. He was also, you know, the richest man in the world at that time. And when World War II ended, he had $100 billion in Swiss bank accounts. That's not coming from Douglas or me. That's independent. And $100 billion, and that was in those days, not $100 billion today.
Wow.
$100 billion in those days. So it would probably, you know, go into the trillions.
Trillions.
But he was the richest man on earth, and he could fund his own private air force, which is what he did. It was not... The United States and Japan were two countries at that time that did not have an air force. They had, but he created his own private air force, and it was largely driven by dirigibles, which was based upon the failed technology of United States and Germany. They ceased to operate because they'd been sabotaged. You know, the most famous mishap of the German technology sort of died with the Hindenburg, and the Americans had dirigible technology too, but it was undermined because of Filipino stewards that had been kidnapped by the United States Army or Navy in the Spanish-American War. These people weren't citizens. They just took them and used them as slaves. And the Filipinos were very, and Japanese were, you know, in concert. Some of them spoke the same language, and they undermined the Filipino stewards who were being exploited by the Americans, easily planted bombs and undermined the dirigible technology. Well, Hirohito took the dirigible technology of the Germans and the Americans, and he improved upon it. And he created these huge balloons. They would be a huge balloon in the center with eight around it, so that if one balloon got damaged, the other ones would sustain it with hydrogen, much more flammable than helium. America had a monopoly on helium, so the Germans and the Japanese used hydrogen. But Hirohito's balloons, they were capable of airlift of many, you know, hundreds of tons, and they could have small tanks, which we have a picture of the small tanks they used, airplanes, They could hang the airplanes like Peking ducks and bring them in and out, and they could cover up everything. And they were also capable of carrying biological weapons that were dropped in canisters. And they knew exactly the right time of day to drop them. And they experimented on these in the Chinese wars they were having. And they could also kind of gauge it better because the Chinese live in self-contained areas, 5 to 10 miles. They don't travel out of that their entire lives. And you can't travel into these areas by highways or roads. You've got to go by the river. Now, at that time, the United States, FDR, who's thought of as a hero, was really quite the opposite. He had a war plan to invade Canada. This is all historically documentable. He was going to invade Canada. And what he really wanted, and Japan and all these other countries, he wanted to invade Canada. And the English crown was afraid of this because Hitler was advancing throughout Europe. And they were afraid they might need an escape place to go. And that was going to be Canada. So that's why FDR wanted to invade Canada. And he was going to cut off the safety of the royal English crown. So what he did is he made a deal that he would not invade Canada and they would give him the opium trade of Southeast Asia, known as the Golden Triangle. Now, the opium trade is a whole nother story. It goes back. The British mandated that every Chinese person buy so much opium per month. And this sustained the British Empire. So Roosevelt wanted that power. And now this was totally outside the U.S. government. It was his own. He had his own private air force, which was the Flying Tigers, which was run by communist Marines who were loyal, you know, to communism. And this is all historical fact. It's all mentioned in there in the book. But and FDR was very pro-communist. He was very much aligned with Stalin. His top financial officer or person was a Canadian named Laughlin Curry, who was actually investigated the FBI and found, you know, his behavior was treasonous. And he was telling people how, you know, he had told Stalin that he had Roosevelt under his thumb and, you know, was influencing his financial policy and the New Deal and all this. So instead of prosecuting Laughlin Curry, Roosevelt protected him and sent him off to work with Mao Zedong in China and to work with the Marines and to have them sneak into a, what was the name? It was peace negotiations. I think it was in Nanjing, which was then the capital of China. And he had the Americans dress up as Chinese coolies and go in and attack the peace negotiations. And the Japanese thought because they were dressed like Chinese, they were Chinese. And they were so angry at the Chinese, it became the rape of Nanjing. And the Japanese attacked the Chinese. It set back peace between the two countries. And then after interrogating the Chinese prisoners, they realized that it wasn't Chinese who did this, it was Caucasians. So this is 1937. They bombed the U.S. or the Her Majesty's Lady Bird, it was called, a British ship, and in December of 1937, and the Panay, a U.S. ship. And this was the beginning of World War II, actively hostilities. It was considered this. America, Congress would never declare it a war, although there was active hostilities between the Japanese and the British and the Americans, because if the truth came out, the America would look horrible. So they didn't call it a war. This is one of the things that led to World War II being proclaimed after Pearl Harbor. This created a justifiable excuse, which was really the U.S. was economically strangling Japan at that time. The details of this are gone into in the book. I won't belabor them here.
What I'd like to say to Peter real quickly is that everything that you've shared so far, and to read the full book, I think people are going to get a real big picture that what was happening then, it's still going on right now. This is the result.
Very much so. And it's very important that this book be read because it's getting a very weird welcome because it is so ontologically shocking. It shocks the system. So Emperor Hirohito is getting these balloons as weapons of war. So when Pearl Harbor happens in 1941, and war is declared, in 6 or 7 weeks, February 24th, 25th, 1942. He shells the Santa Barbara coast of California to see what the response would be. There's no response. So then he unleashes these super dirigibles over the city of Los Angeles. And it frightens the hell out of the city of Los Angeles in 1942. Now, keep in mind that there's now a Hollywood picture, the Battle of Los Angeles. This is all about UFOs. It's all nonsense. That's all disinformation, trying to make you think it's aliens. Well, what it was they had these super dirigibles, and Hirohito had you know, defeated the Americans at Pearl Harbor, and now he had a Los Angeles. And the Americans were frightened. The army was frightened because they knew he was using a yellow fever virus in China. So they thought that he was going to spill it on the population. So they created an instant yellow fever vaccine, which it had no approval. It was instantly created. It killed 50,000 of their own troops almost immediately, disabled 300,000 others who were mustered out of the service thereafter. And he'd won a war. He wasn't releasing weapons on the Americans. He was scaring them. He wanted peace. He wanted trade. He never wanted to fight the Americans. They wanted to fight him. They wanted to take over Japan. They wanted to build a railroad going back to the 1800s. They wanted to build a railroad from Japan that went all the way up to, you know, you can make a bridge from Japan to Korea very easily, up to Korea, across the Siberia and into Moscow. This is what the railroad barons wanted. So Hirohito, he wanted peace. He wanted trade. He wanted an economy for his people who needed to be fed. So this is the background, some of the background of World War II. There's much more involved. But as a marine biologist, he was not only studying the yellow fever virus and other microbiology. He had a whole unit, 731. There's books written about that, about how to biological warfare. But he also was studying the air currents. And there was something called the Kuroshio Current, which goes up the coast of Japan, across the northern Pacific, south of Alaska, down the U.S. coast. And that's, these dirigibles could get over there in 3 days. And because we're running into time considerations here.
We're doing a part two.
Okay, well, but because, well, then I will add in, the Battle of Midway is considered to be the turning point in the war for the Americans. Not really true. Hirohito let them have Midway. He gave them their aircraft carriers because they were of no real strategic or even tactical importance. What Hirohito was, he invaded the Aleutian Islands. The Aleutian Islands were not only a point of attack into America, it was more of a preventative attack, because if the Americans had the Aleutians, they could send bombing craft to more easily bomb Japan and or Asia. And the Americans did not know about the Kuroshio Current. So when they tried to bomb Japan, they ran into these terrific headwinds. It was terrifically frustrating. As a result of them having their attention on Midway and not the Aleutians, the Japanese took the Aleutians, protected their main island, and America had to go on this ridiculous invasion of the Pacific, which was like pulling teeth to get to Japan, which they never did do. They never could get to Japan. The closest they could get to Okinawa, which is oftenly thought of as Japan, but it's not Japan. It's part of the Ryukyu Island, and it has its own flag and everything. It was a protectorate of Japan, but it was not Japan itself. So the Americans never got to Japan. They spent more men, lost more men in Okinawa than were lost on D-Day. And they could never, they took Okinawa, but at great cost to themselves. And they couldn't take, and they knew if they went out Japan, they would have a much bigger fight. So that's why they went for the atomic bomb. And when they did go for the atomic bomb, they had to get the first bomb, called Little Boy, from Germany. Germany created the bomb. And this is documented. They had unleashed a bomb in the 1940s. Forget the exact date right now. It's in the book. But Hitler did not want atomic warfare because it would damage the genetics of the Aryans. So he didn't want atomic warfare. It was too brutal in his estimation. So, but the Germans had invented an atom bomb, and the Japanese had their own atomic bomb, which is, even the newspapers which feature it are mentioned. And this is where Korea, they did it in Korea. And this is why the Koreans have nuclear weapons to this day, the Northern Koreans, because there was a whole Japanese base there. And when they left it behind them, and that's why how the neutral zone in K- 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 Korea was created by the blasting of atomic bombs by the Japanese. So there is so much history that is not told. So the Americans got what was called Little Boy. They dropped it on Hiroshima. And then they were working on their own bomb, a plutonium bomb. That was a uranium bomb. They're working on their own plutonium bomb, which was they called Fat Man. And that was the one that was dropped very clumsily on Nagasaki. It was the wrong target, Nagasaki. And this did no damage to the Japanese military because it was all on the Asian mainland. It was not in Japan, all their troops and whatnot. So these were not deterring the Japanese at all. And so what Hirohito did on as soon as they dropped the bomb on Hiroshima, he sent off one of these three super dirigibles, huge ones, to America. And they were going to land in Nevada at where the Army had its top aircraft, latest weapons. That was called Tonopah Army Airfield, which is now known as Area 51. And he showed one of the ones did not make it. It crashed in New Mexico, Aztec, New Mexico, I believe it was. And there's been a whole UFO myth created around that, which it was not at all. The UFO, it was only a Japanese dirigible. Two landed. The Americans then saw all the weapons that he had, all these biological weapons. They sent them to Fort Detrick, and they said that he could not only wipe out the whole human race, he could wipe out America really fast, because he'd also been sending over balloon bombs called Fugo balloons with the air currents, and they were causing firestorms all across the Northwest. And he was sending out planes from submarines to map the air currents. Hirohito was mapping the currents so he could send his dirigibles by wind to various areas of the United States if he wanted to wipe out the United States. So they knew his capabilities. And he had been trying, they had given him the Potsdam Declaration, which said, you know, total surrender. And he said, you know, I will agree to your terms, except that the emperor has to stay in power. This will not influence the sovereignty of the emperor, which basically means if the emperor is sovereign, he's sovereign. So yeah, I'll accept your terms, but not for my sovereignty, which means he accepted everything remained under his control. And we can go into his whole relationship with General MacArthur as well another time. I will get to the gusto here, but he bribed MacArthur with all of the gold he had taken from when he invaded all of Asia and took all the gold, buried it in tunnels in the Philippines. There's all books written on that. And this is outside of his $100 billion personal fortune. And he bribed MacArthur with, and that's even been documented, that MacArthur has accepted a bribe of what amounted to, I think, $500,000, which would be about $7 million in today's money. And he was known as the emperor's general. But anyway, the Americans, he left the dirigibles with the Americans, and the Americans kept the tiny Japanese that were in there. They were Yakuza. They, as part of their own atonement ritual, they would cut off their pinky. So they had three fingers. They would shave all their body hair, including their eyelashes, because the hydrogen balloons were so flammable. If anything caught fire, they didn't want their hair to catch fire. So they were, you know, naked. I mean, with their body hair. The only thing they might have had were eyelashes. So some of them survived. Well, anyway, they were forced. The Americans were forcing these people to comply. The Americans were not big enough to get in the small enough to get in the craft. So only the little Yakuza could get in them. They were about 4 feet high, no more than that. The average Japanese was no more than 5 feet high at that time. So they were forcibly mistreating them. They were as prisoners of war, and they were mistreating them. So some of them escaped in some of the planes. And those are the planes that were flying over Washington when Kenneth Arnold saw them. And that's where the word flying saucer got coined by the press, like flying saucers. 1947, a couple of weeks before Roswell, those were Japanese escaping. And then we have them being forced. The Americans wanted to use these dirigibles to go do what Admiral Byrd's expedition, Operation High Jump, could not do in Antarctica, which was to beat the Third Reich in exile. They could not beat them. So they wanted to use these to beat the Third Reich, which they wouldn't have worked anyway. But anyway, they were trying to force these Yakuza, and the Yakuza were doing a over the Four Corners. Apparently the winds blew over to Roswell area and they self-immolated. rather than to be subject to the Americans. This was the Roswell crash. And because it involves so much misbehavior and war crimes on behalf of the Americans to themselves with what they did in the Battle of Los Angeles, they're hiding all this information. And the fact that they kept prisoners of war in the Japanese, they're guilty of war crimes. This has been hidden. And eventually a Roswell Museum was created. And all of this was done under the Roswell Museum was all done under the tutelage of Michael Aquino, the satanic chaplain of the U.S. Army, who wrote the chaplain's handbook for the U.S. Army, and who was the founder of the Temple of Set, who's now passed away.
Talk about major marketing distraction. Unbelievable. Yeah.
Yes. And this is what we're dealing. So as we will get into the next book, it goes deep into the Satanism in the U.S. Army and in at the Presidio, and how Douglas pulled the plug on it and created such a ruckus in the press that they had to shut the Presidio down. It was a satanic playground, and it's far more bizarre. Now, this particular book, which the Roswell Deception, I encourage everybody to go out and not only buy it, but circulate it, because we've never had such a stoppage of a book. It's not
so
like,
we can get it where now? Make sure we can get it on Amazon, on your site.
On Amazon, on Kindle. You can get it at, buy it on Amazon. You can buy it from Skybooks. It's skybooksusa.com. But I'm just saying is we've never had a book. It got off to a okay start, but then it just died because people are like, they don't know what to think. So we've been pushing it, and we're starting to get a little bit of momentum now. But it's like people believe in all of this alien stuff that they've been programmed to believe. And there's other stories behind these whole alien abductions, which is not in this book, but it gets tied into, it's not what people think it is. It's not aliens coming to ET coming to, help you.
Rescue you. Yes. But the deception, the level of deception, not only in this area that we're speaking about, but in general, it makes you realize why we have the chaos that we have today, because people are so completely oblivious, misinformed, and most people will not take the time to do their own research of any deep magnitude.
It's also important, Sonia, that I mentioned there's a chapter in there called Black Lives Didn't Matter. And this is about conscientious objectors who were Black, who were sent. They had Black paratroopers called the Triple Nickels who used to put out these forest fires. And they wanted Black people doing it because Black people wouldn't circulate with white people in those days. So it would all remain silent. And they hid the Triple Nickels by spelling Nickels different. Instead of spelling it ELS, they spelled it LES, the English way. So if you go to look up Triple Nickels, you couldn't find anything in the archives. But what they did with the conscientious objectors, who were a special division of the Triple Nickels that were Black, they created something called Black Parachutes. And not because they were Black in color, or I don't remember if they were, but because they were basically meant to open in such a way that they wouldn't work and they would break the bones of the parachuters. And this was killing, genociding Black people. And these people are still strewn across the Northwest. This is the type of stuff that the U.S. Army was doing. And these are all part of the crimes they're hiding and why they foster this alien myth.
But unbelievable, Peter, yes. Because, you know, people clearly cannot understand why there's been such hesitation with this group of people, with, as they say, you know, African-Americans, Black people in general, about going ahead with the certain mandates today.
How can they trust them? And you know,
so we've got like a minute left.
Yeah. And how can anybody trust them? Also, they create things like QAnon, which all comes from Michael Aquino. And that, I have the whole history of QAnon. It's not in the book. It'll be in the next book. It's in my newsletter, because Q is the X word in Japanese. Instead of saying X files, they say Q files. So it's something that he co-opted from the Japanese that he learned from my co-author, Douglas Dietrich.
So this
stuff goes deep. It's incredible. So I encourage everybody to check the book out, and you will want to know more. And the more you buy of this book, the more we can produce more books, which are revealing more of this disclosure. This is the disclosure everybody
wants. This is the true disclosure.
It is
true. Right. Well, we love fantasy. So that's, you know, that's all part of it as well. And, you know, we love Hollywood and all of the experiences that Hollywood has thrown up, bestowed upon us or projected. And I think, you know, we're going to have you back for part two. We're basically out of time. We're going to have you back for part two so that maybe we can follow up with this on the very next show as well. But I think people need to keep in mind how this all relates to this moment in time. We haven't really touched on that, but you can see a trail as to how this moment in time and everything that's going on, how it is an extension of all that Teeter has discussed and the little that he has discussed really at this point. So do check out the book. Please check out the book. If you can't remember, the link is going to be on the expansionzone.com. Teeter, thank you so much. And we'll make arrangements for this, for the part two. Thank you so much for being here. And thank you, Douglas, as well, for all your work. And remember to check out theexpansionzone.com for the archive for this show and all other shows and YouTube channel and so on. And if you want to know more about my work, do visit therealsoniabarrett.com. As always, I remind you to live life to its fullest and question everything. Until next time, see you then.
Everybody's talking about consciousness. Everybody wants that eternal kiss.
The Bradcast.
Experts have said that the case has little chance of success at the Supreme Court, much like the numerous other GOP election lawsuits, that are pending in battleground states. But then again, those experts